This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. It's Tech's Expert Day, and we're talking about artificial intelligence, including the security threats it may pose. And back with us is Jesse LeGrew. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. In addition to AI, we're going to talk about with him about how to spring clean your personal devices. How full is your computer storage? Maybe you have thousands of files, but nowhere to put them. I can relate. We'll take your general tech questions, too. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Welcome back, Jesse.
Good to be here.
Yeah. Well, glad to see your face, even if it is on a computer screen, which I think is appropriate when we have you on, actually. So let's just get to this whole AI thing. You know, there was a Reuters poll not too long ago that revealed that 2/3 of Americans are concerned about the negative effects of AI. But before we do that, what is AI? So people who are maybe not confused can understand it a little better.
Yeah, and I mean, we hear about AI or artificial intelligence all the time. We see it a lot more in the news and the media, but we've also seen it in science fiction. So a lot of us have been introduced to it for movies. I mean, people think about, you know, the Terminator. There's a version, probably not what we're seeing today, but it's really for what we think about this kind of tool set. There's layers to it. So artificial intelligence isn't just what we kind of think of as artificial general intelligence, something that can kind of really mimic, human intelligence. There are other aspects to it. And I think another thing we hear very often is about machine learning. So being able to take a large amount of data and to either better understand what that data is, or maybe use it as a predictor for future outcomes. But that's, you know, one of many different ideas out there. We also hear about large language models, which is really what ChatGPT is, being able to be trained on a large set of data, and then really try to give us, language content based upon the prompts that we give it. And so we give it some kind of information, and based on its training data, it gives us a quote unquote solution, or at least what it predicts to be an appropriate response to our question. So not necessarily actually the quote unquote intelligence that we talk about. It's not, but it's using data to really give us a response. And that can be, very, very simplistic, or it can be much more complicated when we think about especially large language models like ChatGPT. We've also seen it even in the last decade or two in the news when thinking about things such as Watson playing Jeopardy, or if we think about Garry Kasparov playing chess against Deep Blue. Also very variations of artificial intelligence, very different in its application, and really trained in those cases to really do one thing and do one thing really well. It's not trained to do kind of everything. It has a specific application that you can use it for.
So like we said in the beginning, AI is pretty much everywhere these days. Where do we find it in our everyday lives?
Yeah, I think one common thing that I think about, especially as we talk about ChatGPT and kind of, what I think most people consider kind of human-like responses, or, the language itself seems to be relatively understandable, maybe sometimes a little bit quote-unquote robotic, but it gives us data. Grammarly, I think, is actually an interesting product that people use on a day-to-day basis. That is very much a machine learning artificial intelligence system that helps to correct our grammar. And that's probably one of the more complicated mechanisms where a lot of that data is being analyzed and reanalyzed in a data center somewhere far off. But we also do have it in word processing programs that we're using today. How do those dictionaries actually get generated, and how does it actually give us that feedback? And so those are some very, very big examples we see in our day-to-day lives. But we also see it. I know I've had this before. I've gotten called from my bank. By the way, you have these five charges. Can you please let us know if these are yours? So based on the data that they're being fed, they have indicators that say this looks a little unusual from what Jesse does on a day-to-day basis. Because of that, I'm going to reach out and just validate that these are purchases that were made by him. We see that a lot now, where it actually lowers the barrier. And it might be a person, it might be actually completely automated, where there's not even a person on the other end of the phone, and you're just simply saying, yes, this is mine, no, this isn't. And based on that, they can actually, cancel your card, make sure you get a new one to protect against any other fraudulent purchases, or say, oh, this is you, so we're going to make sure you can continue to use your card. Thanks for answering, and go about your day. And that's something where sometimes days or weeks later, rather than maybe minutes or hours, where you can actually get that response, and it helps to prevent fraud, and allows you to keep using those resources. So lots of day-to-day examples.
So basically, when we're on social media and we see an ad pop up that was something that we maybe talked about an hour ago, is that artificial intelligence?
Yeah, in a lot of cases it is. There's a variety of ways that different companies can kind of use that data. Most of our activity, whether we want it to or not, is tracked to help build a profile for us as individuals, as consumers. It might be through a grocery store, it might be through an online retailer, it might be through social media, it might actually be through all those, because a lot of times they try to link all those data points up to really understand what you're interested in. So all of those are really taken into account to say, hey, you might be interested in this. Let me give you some more information. So in a lot of cases, there's large databases behind the scenes, and there is usually some kind of algorithm behind to make decisions and tweak those algorithms from that kind of shopping experience. And social media sites like Facebook, they have their own thing, but they do something similar.
Yes, certainly. We see a lot of those. So the big thing that we've heard about lately is the whole ChatGPT. Explain what that is and what can it do for us?
Yeah, ChatGPT is a large language model, and it's really meant to kind of replicate a language experience. So you ask it a question, it can give you a text-based response. A lot of people have actually been using it for a variety of things. I think one thing people are scared about is people falsifying work. So, write me an essay for this, or give me whatever data you're looking for. It can also generate code, which ChatGPT 4, you can give it a problem and it can actually create computer code that you could use. Either for good things or for bad things, but it can really help you do a variety of things with less knowledge. I think one of the interesting items with ChatGPT, depending on w the questions that are being asked, and how complicated or how much knowledge is needed to interpret it, in many cases, a subject matter expert is really needed to help validate, is this good enough? As what I'm getting, what I would normally intend to be an appropriate response, is there what they call hallucinations, where it kind of makes up an answer you don't anticipate, or it doesn't really have the data for. It can be used for a lot of great things. I actually have been very interested in using it for kind of brainstorming. You kind of get stuck on a problem, like, well, I don't know what to do next. It can help to get through a little bit of a roadblock to brainstorm, at least to kind of move forward. The answer may not be exactly what I'd want it to be, but it helps generate a new idea that I can kind of move forward with a problem. And I've also seen it used quite a bit in simulations, where even if it's simulating a conversation actually between two individuals or between a group of individuals, where it can build a complete script that you can actually use to kind of walk through and discuss with others, which has been really, really interesting. But there's, you know, so many different applications just based on, you know, how much we use really text-based language on a day-to-day basis.
So you think of it can be used mostly as a tool rather than something that's going to be taking over. Is that a good way to think about it?
Yeah, and I think like anything, we have a variety of tools, and they can be used for good or bad purposes. It's not necessarily the tool itself that is negative, or positive. It's just, you know, it depends how we want to use it. And so I think it can be used for, you know, good or bad things. It just depends on the intent of the individual that's actually using it. So I think, while I think there are, you know, risks to it, I think there are risks to any tool that we use. But I think it serves us well to think about the positive ways we can use the technology and the other ways that we can actually have it benefit our day-to-day lives. I also think that just trying to use it can actually help us combat those scarier things, the negative things that people might be interested in using them for.
What about the ethics involved? I mean, we can fake videos, we can fake photos, we can fake all kinds of things. I know some legislators are looking at what can we do to kind of make sure that people aren't, you know, fooled by this kind of stuff. What do you think about that?
I think there, with any kind of technology, with anything that can be misused, I think having some kind of regulation or, you know, laws governing its use can be useful. I think that there will always be somebody that will work around it and try to use it for, you know, bad things. It's just
Sure.
going to happen. Disinformation, I think, is a real big risk as well, especially when, you know, the output is so easy to generate and can easily fool most people. And I think that's one of the more interesting aspects when thinking about that subject matter expert in the back. Like, I really know this topic really, really well. When I read this, I know it's not correct. But for most other people that aren't, you know, in that field, they may not be able to make that judgment, or at least not from an educated background and just know enough to be able to do that.
Go ahead.
I was gonna stay too. It's a problem we have today, even before technology. Disinformation, the you know, modification of sources to deliver to a large mass of individuals, has existed for a very, very long time, even before having computers. It just gives it, it kind of lowers the bar in terms of how easy it is to generate it. And but it's the same problem. It's just a different application for it. And, you know, there's things we can do, but there's also some things we just can't. The technology's out there, and it's really easy to at least get access to it. Some of it's easy to use. Some of it might require some more technical background, but I think that's also the interesting aspect of the technology is if people really want to use it and use it for good things, it's there.
And so buyer beware, as we always say. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Jesse LeGru is with us today. And if you've got any tech questions or maybe you've got a comment about AI, all lines are open, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and A. Emily Ralph is our technical director.
Website. Some require registration, some don't. ChatGPT itself also has kind of the basic free version, but if you want to pay a little bit more to get access to some more of the features, or just use it more because it's really kind of a use threshold, you can do that too. But it's, you know, nicely available online. Just go to a website, type in your question or prompt, and then kind of go from there. There are other applications that you can install on a smartphone. You don't necessarily need to, though. If you just want to test it out, see what it is, you can do that too. And ChatGPT is, the online interface is really, really easy to use. And I think one of the, if people are interested in using it and asking it questions, one I'd always recommend, don't give it personal information or sensitive data, just because you wouldn't want that, you know, being put out there or reused in any way. You know, just kind of caution about that. But I also recommend, as you type in information, it is really dialogue driven. So when you do type in a prompt and it gives you an answer, you can have it refine that answer or kind of dig deeper into the problem or the question that you posed. So actually using kind of that as a thread feature, where it's almost like you're kind of having a dialogue with the computer, I guess, can actually help to generate even better content. So I do recommend people converse, I guess, with ChatGPT to really refine the information that's being presented.
Now, ChatGPT is its own brand name, right? It's like a type of software, or it's not a generic name. Like, is it like Kleenex and tissue?
Yeah, it's created by OpenAI, which is the organization. GPT actually stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, which is something no one's ever going to remember, but it goes back to that large language model and an aspect of artificial intelligence. So there's Venn diagrams out there if people try to look at it. There are several different types of artificial intelligence. You know, large language models is one, and you can see different fragments or different types of artificial intelligence. And this is kind of one aspect of it, using this trained data to give you a response. But OpenAI is the company, and ChatGPT is really what they frame the title of their software.
Okay. Well, Clara said there are two questions about AI generated by Bard, which is Google's AI. And the first one is, what are the future possibilities of artificial intelligence? Well, that's wide open, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the possibilities really go quite a bit, quite far in terms of how we want to use it, maybe how we don't want to use it. And not only just with large language models like Bard or ChatGPT, but also with image generation, video generation, not just from, you know, I think the things we're always worried about, which is disinformation and falsifying data, but also for creating simulations. So thinking of it as a tool that can be used to generate content to be used for learning, or even media, movies. I mean, there's so many different works out there, animated movies that teams and teams of people create. It could potentially help simplify what they're doing to work on harder problems, which I think is one of the interesting things with artificial intelligence. There's, you know, potential risk depending on the use or misuse of the technology, but I also could think it can help us remove roadblocks in certain areas to allow us to focus on higher level problems instead of the sometimes, I guess, more annoying small problems that kind of come up, you get stuck with for hours, like, oh, yes, it's so easy to fix that. And it's like, well, this could just, it could get you past that roadblock really quick. And then you're focused on the higher level, the real work you actually want to do. And I think that's a great opportunity for artificial intelligence, is to potentially help us to do that and focus on the other work that we want to do. And so working alongside these tools rather than in an adversarial situation where you feel like it's kind of us or them, I think working with the technology can help us do better things. And it might help me mow my lawn, actually. So that,
yes, because they've got those little robotic ones.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of possibility for it. And I think us also considering what the risks might be, how to address those and make sure we're using it in a safe way is important. But I think there's a lot of great possibilities for using it, not just for, you know, like science, but also for art and other and other fields. Others would, might disagree, but I think there's possibility. And so I think there's something to be said for embracing it.
Absolutely. Well, it's not going anywhere, so we should probably make friends with it, right? Well, apparently everybody's so enthralled with your questions or talk about AI that nobody's calling. So come on, people, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. I can't believe that nobody has a tech problem. But let us talk about cleaning our computers. I thought that was a great idea to spring clean our computers. There's so much stuff. Where do we even start, Jesse?
Yeah, that's it's actually an interesting problem. I was thinking about this both with like a personal computer where I have all my files and things. What do I do with them? How do I make sure they're backed up? Do I even need them anymore? And yes. I think that's one of the biggest questions. There are programs out there, and actually I think a lot of them are even built into like Windows computers or Mac computers, like show me the age of these files. How old are they? And do I really need to keep these, or can I delete them? So using those, I think, to review what's on your computer and just deciding yes or no, and throw it in the trash or decide to keep it. But I think there's also the aspect of the other resources we use that are maybe not on our computer, or maybe a copy is, but it's not where it's stored. So I think about whether it's Google Cloud, whether it's in Microsoft, Dropbox, any other cloud-based or internet-based resource. Those are also places where we store things that we need to consider. Either, do we want to save it, or do we even need it? And one thing that we're seeing with a lot of the vendors is, after a certain amount of time, if an account's inactive, if files haven't been used, we're just going to delete it.
Yeah.
And part of that is for just making they're trying to keep their own environments tidy. We only want accounts active if they're needed. We only want data out there if it's needed, because it costs resources. It's storage. It's user accounts that could actually be used for bad things instead of good things. Actually trying to clean that up, I think, is a big interest of those companies. But it also means for us, if I don't use data after a certain amount of time, I might need to make sure I back it up. Because yeah. If I don't, that could go away. And so I think there's those kind of two aspects of if you don't need it and you don't think you're going to use it, go ahead and remove it. But if somebody else is housing it, and if you think you do want it, make sure to make a backup copy. And that could be to your computer. That could be to a flash drive, to an external hard drive. It could be to another third-party service. But either way, making sure you have copies of that before anything like that happens is really important, especially because we are seeing more and more storage limits. It's free unlimited until it's not. And then when it's not, you either have to pay, or that some of that data is not going to be there anymore.
Well, I had the bright idea not too long ago that I needed to clean out my 10 years of email that I had on my private email, and I got rid of everything. And I'm very upset that I did, because there's a lot of searching that I could do for things that I can't get anymore. It's gone. So be careful about what you get rid of. Let's go to Tom in Madison. He's got a comment about the AI again. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've been a performer, an individual, independent contractor kind of performer for over 40 years. And this reminds me so much of the arguments and debate we had when computers came in. And I love computers. I no longer spend, thousands of dollars on printing and mailing. When it comes to technology in general, I don't spend up to $200 or $300 a month for long-distance phone calls. I think it's absolutely incredible. But on the other hand, I'm working more hours than I did before all the technology came along. And I find that for every sort of anything that tries to pass as a labor-saving device, it just doesn't. You just end up doing other things. And if you work for someone else, that means your boss is going to ask you to do some more things, and Americans are notoriously bad when it comes to the amount that we work.
Very true. Thanks, Tom. Good to hear your voice. So, Jesse, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think that's really true. That, you know, that boundary can be challenging. And, you know, while it does open up the time for other work, that other work can still be extremely consuming.
Yes.
And it's a continual balance that is challenging, especially, I think, in America, specifically in terms of, you know, how much we're working versus how much we're not, with even the thought of just being in an office or not, that barrier between, you know, the workplace and being at home can be challenging. The one interesting thing, and I was thinking about it when Tom was speaking, was, you know, that understanding where that line is. And there's actually a lot of interesting artificial intelligence tools that are now meant to say, hey, by the way, it looks like you're working a little bit more this week than you were last week, or you have some more time here than you otherwise would. So it can also be a good prompt to help us evaluate maybe something we're not seeing. It's really easy for me to ignore. I'm working one extra minute a day every day. But then I do that for 6 months. Well, that's 180 minutes that I'm spending at that very end of that day than I did at the start.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I make sure that I'm keeping in tune with that and really managing my time? And sometimes I can do it myself. Sometimes I'm not great at it. And so I think some of the tools can actually help us in that regard, even though we do have always more work to do. AI can help us scale where we can do more, but that more also just means some of that time gets used too. So yeah, I think it's a challenge. It's an interesting one to think about, and maybe some of the tools can help us address
Definitely.
It, maybe not.
Definitely, good point. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sullivan in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Sullivan.
Hi, question. So what is the difference between an algorithm like that we see on social media and AI?
Oh, good question. What's your answer, Jesse?
So artificial intelligence is really going to be kind of comprised of some kind of algorithm or some kind of rules that are set up by an individual. I think the bridge that happens between when we think of like a large language model or like machine learning, there's only a certain amount of input that the human is giving in terms of here's what to do. It gives constraints. So I'd say, here's your data. Here's how I've cleaned it up. And here are some basic rules, how I want you to process the data. But in terms of the actual decision-making by the computer, it's generating a lot of that based upon the data. So I'm really giving it a start, but the computer's generating how it's going to interpret any kind of prompts after that point by itself. And so it's really being refined by that model or by that machine learning program. I'm just really trying to give it constraints or kind of a starting point to do something. And that's a really simplistic answer and may not be completely true in every situation. But we're used to, I write a program, I'm going to tell it, if you give me this answer, you're going to go to A or B. For a artificial intelligence, I am really giving it the inputs for it to decide whether it should be A or B. And that could be by telling it what A or B is, or by letting it try to figure out itself what A or B is. And so there's different ways to do it with artificial intelligence, whether it is me supplying an answer or me trying to have that program do it itself.
Okay. Thank you, Jesse, and thank you for that question, Sullivan. Let's go to Dousman now. Hi, Carrie. What question do you have?
Hi. I have two questions. One is, what do you recommend for saving passwords? We all have so many passwords we have to save.
Yeah, so on the saving passwords, I recommend any kind of password manager. I think everyone's going to have a different suggestion in terms of what the best one's going to be. There's generally two common kinds. One is going to be one that's completely offline. So it's on your computer, it's a file that you have stored, and it's going to have a basically a master password or a primary password that's used to unlock that password container. Once you get in, you have access to all your passwords. It could be websites that you're loading that you might copy into a website, or it could be a password you're using to maybe unlock a device. But it allows you to have a reference. So consider it like a digital notebook that just has all your information. Downside about that, if you have multiple devices, if you're traveling and that password container is stored in another device, you can't access it. So that's a challenge. So they do have internet-based or cloud-based solutions that allow you to store passwords in one location and synchronize them with multiple devices. This can be really, really handy. I have iOS devices, Windows devices, and Android devices. And I need to use them all for a variety of things. So I do want to have something that can synchronize and allow me to access all those passwords from one location, from a web browser or from a mobile app. And so for me, that is something that I feel I need. Once again, everyone's going to be a little bit different. But really, those are going to be the one of the two primary ones that you're going to see. There are password managers built in the browsers. I don't recommend using those for a few reasons. One is a lot of web attacks just are very common. So we see phishing emails and a lot of things happening on a day-to-day basis. When you click on any kind of bad link, it's possible data within that browser could be exposed or otherwise compromised. And a lot of times, depending on how the browser stores it, it may be easy to recover for somebody else. So it may not be as private as you think it is. But it all depends on how you're using your browser, what links you're clicking on. There are ways to try to lower that risk too, but I'd normally recommend using a locally stored password vault or using a cloud-based solution. I think even recently, LastPass had a data breach. It's almost been a year at this point. I think it was August of 2022. KeePass, which is a local password vault that you can save on your computer, that also has had a reported vulnerability and issue over the last, I think it was last week or two. So also keep up on the news and kind of what's being used there. But those are at least some general suggestions. Depending on your use, kind of pick what works best for you. And if you can, enable multi-factor authentication with it. So have a separate, whether it's a key, whether it's a biometric, so like a fingerprint, iris scan, or a different code, I think having that is really important.
Yeah, it's a safe thing, and most programs allow you to do that these days, most apps, so that's great. Jesse LeGrew is back with us today. He is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. What tech questions do you have for us? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow at this time, Dr. Bill Stark will be back. He's going to be talking about microchipping your pet and how to choose a flea and tick repellent. That's Tuesday, starting at 11, right here on the Ideas Network. And let's go back to the phones, Jesse. We've got Ron in La Crosse with a question. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
What's up?
Hi, I'm really impressed by the possibilities being talked about, but I have some questions about actualities. In particular, I got two questions. One of them has to do with on my cell phone. I pick it up, and then it says scam likely on it. And I'm wondering about what the actual state of affairs or issues are concerning why that doesn't go directly to the Wisconsin Department of Fraud and Consumer Protection. I'll listen to the answer to that, and I've got a second question.
Okay. Jesse, you want to address that first one?
Yeah, and the scam likely, generally those are from centralized databases in terms of these numbers we would normally anticipate as a scam call, giving you the option to answer or not to answer in case it's wrong, which, you know, it's a possibility. I actually don't answer those calls at all, so I guess I haven't tested it too much in terms of which ones are real or not, but I don't usually get too many phone calls these days, just with kind of the change in the use of phones. And exactly what that's reported, I'm actually uncertain. So I don't know if the different cell phone carriers do have, you know, a centralized database that they share or one that they only use themselves. That's actually, I'd be kind of curious if anyone else has kind of a note on that. But usually from what I've experienced with those notifications, they've been pretty accurate. If I've answered like one or two, they definitely seem scammy. I don't want to answer it. And a lot of times with those phone calls, if you do answer and reply, it actually might inadvertently add you to something anyway. So not answering in a lot of those cases is a really good idea. Usually if it is going to be somebody, you know, they're going to be in your phone book, they're going to be, you know, not on that list. So, it's actually been relatively accurate for me, whether that's reported to, either Wisconsin or other states, for their own consumer protection, that I do not have the answer to.
Well, our consumer protection experts will be with us a week from Thursday, Ron. So if you want to call back and ask them, but I think they'll probably tell you that that would create a lot of man hours or person hours for answering all those questions or those calls. So anyway, Ron, what's your second question?
My second question is 60 Minutes had a special last night, spent 15 minutes on people getting a phone call saying their grandkid has been kidnapped and they're scamming people. Is there any way that something can be done by the phone service companies to have a button you can push on your phone immediately to have that sent to law enforcement? Because by the time you try to deal with law enforcement, the problem has escalated so much that, well, there's a catastrophe on the way. So why isn't there something on your phone that can immediately put that call into law enforcement?
Okay, Jesse, another theoretical for you.
Yeah, it's a good question. Right now, I mean, at least from what I understand for our existing system, we don't have that capability of just direct reporting. It's an interesting idea, and I don't know if there are other, maybe non-US, countries that are actually doing that. That's kind of an interesting challenge. One of the unfortunate things with just our phone system in general is it's extremely insecure. It's actually really easy to falsify phone numbers and other information. And so I think that would be actually challenging. It's probably one of the interesting uses for artificial intelligence, just because of the fact of people to actually take all those phone calls would be extremely daunting, if not impossible, just due to the sheer volume. Because if you think you're getting, let's say, one phone call a day every day, but that's happening to at least 1,000 other people, maybe even just in your state, that's a large amount of phone calls for anyone group to deal with. And so I think having a different way to analyze that information, I think, you know, the benefit of having those scam alert or, scam notifications when you're receiving those phone calls is useful. But yeah, that's an extremely challenging item. It's a good question though for the reporting. And I can't, that's a good question. I don't know how they would actually be able to supply the data. I know there's, websites you can report individual calls to, but to be able to do that en masse, I think is actually useful. If you have 1,000 calls and only one person reports it because it's just a little bit more cumbersome to report, what would it mean if you could actually report all 1,000 or even half of them in a very easy way that's user reportable? The question then comes how to analyze that data and how to act on it in a way that's timely, but also accurate. And I think that's another challenging question. So that's it's a great idea.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ron, for that. I'm sure that there are people out there working on it. Maybe they're working on everything these days. Let's go to Fountain, Minnesota. Hi, Brad. What's your question for us today?
Quick question. I've got a cell phone, a smartphone that's approximately 5 years old, and we've been having trouble last year and a half, very sporadic with picking up cell service. For a couple of weeks, I'll have excellent service, and then all of a sudden, I lose signal all the time. The phone won't reconnect, and I got to do the airplane mode or shut it off. And I was just curious, do you think it's the age of the phone and potential antenna, or do you think I'm having carrier issues?
Okay, thanks, Brad. Jesse?
It could be either. So if it's while you're at home, but nowhere else, one thing I'd probably recommend looking into could be, they have like cell phone repeaters. Usually you can get them from your cell phone provider, but it allows for kind of an enhanced signal when you're inside the house, just because there's a lot of walls, other things that create barriers. If it's while you're traveling and traditionally it's been working really, really well, and it's just an issue now, it could also be maintenance that's actually being planned by your provider as well. So if they are replacing or upgrading services, they could cause disruptions. And if, you know, you are having a cell phone that is, let's say, significantly older, and I'd say probably over 3 years, you may not have 5G. A lot of carriers may be upgrading to 5G. And so there might be some challenges there. So I'd probably contact your cell phone provider first, just to see if they do have service interruptions in your area just due to upgrades. And they would be able to tell you if there's other options for any kind of repeater, if you're having issues specifically in your house. If it's with your phone itself, which is a possibility, I would actually, if you do have other individuals that are using your carrier, honestly, one of the best things to do is to find out others in your area that are using the same provider. If they are having the same issues, that at least points likely to kind of a more systemic change or issue with the provider. If they're not having the issue and only you are, it actually might be your device. So I think that could help narrow down which one it is. It could also be that the device is having issues, not just because of the age, but because of something else. And I think we saw this with iPhones years and years ago, where they had a defect where if you held it in a certain way and only in a certain way, you would have issues. Could be something like that, may not be, but I think checking in with neighbors to see what their experiences are would be helpful. At least it'll help you potentially narrow down whether it's your phone or the carrier.
Okay, thank you, Brad. So, Jesse, does weather have anything to do with cell phone reception? Because I've heard it does, and I've heard it doesn't.
Weather can, especially if it's relying on satellites that are kind of traveling. If it does have to move from different towers to different satellites, depending on where there's interruptions, it could. Generally, it's been pretty resilient in terms of when it's on a cloudy day. I haven't had issues where things are not functioning. But it also does depend on the services available in your area. So if you are in a more densely populated area, it's likely that things are going to be more resilient, where things are going to work if there are little issues. But if you are in a location where there's not as many towers, or there are other kind of issues having more infrastructure, you might run into more issues if there are weather or other environmental issues that could cause problems. So that's kind of another factor, too, is where you are can really impact how that works.
Okay, thank you for answering that for me. Rebecca emailed us. They have an iPad question. Their iPad is about 6 years old, and within the past year, it's been saying that the storage is almost full and that they should remove apps and delete files. But when they look at what's taking up the most space, it's system files and data, and they can't find a way to reduce this data. Is there anything that they can do to free up storage space? Rebecca says it's getting frustrated that they can't even look at email before the storage fills up. That definitely sounds like a problem.
Yeah, if it is system files and it's not primary data like photos or other information, one thing that could help is actually to do a full system backup and restore, which would actually allow it to clear everything out from your device and then restore all your data back. I think the backup is probably the most important aspect of it, just to make sure you have that data. If you do have it synchronized with iCloud, iCloud is generally, it's capped at 5 gigabytes of data, which for some is more than enough, and for others is nowhere near enough. If you have, especially a lot of media, if you have a lot of pictures, if you have a lot of video. So I would potentially recommend doing a full backup. You'll do it with the iTunes application. If you have a fully updated iPad and a fully updated iTunes program on your device, that will at least allow you to back up all of your information. And then once you have that backup, the actual full reset, and I'm, you know, if there were leftover files from updates over the last 5 years or other issues that you were seeing, maybe some of those files just weren't removed correctly. And actually doing that reset might allow you to reset it and then load that data back on. Otherwise, it could just be applications maybe you're not using. So if you do have applications out there, when you do go on to iPad storage, it will show you all of your applications and how much data they're storing. And maybe there's just an app you can delete that will clear up quite a bit of space and kind of help you with that. So I would do a full backup. I would check the storage for those individual apps just to see if there's more that you can remove. Because actually on mine, most of my storage is actually apps and the operating system and not as much with the media. But I also have some apps that if I change some of the settings, it would dramatically reduce the amount of storage. Because for even email itself, you can store last 30 days of email, or you can try to have it store almost as much as possible. And that can easily fill up a device. So I would check the apps, do a full backup just to make sure you have the data available. Because at some point you might need to clear up space in some other way anyway. And so having that backup will at least allow you to go back in case you deleted something you didn't want to delete.
Okay, great. Thanks for that call or that email, Rebecca. Let's go to John in Oshkosh. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi, how are you doing?
We're great. How are you doing?
Lovely. Hey, listen, I got an email in my spam folder from, the end of it was from APT Hacking Group. It said it somehow got access to my email. And they put on a global strike beacon on all the devices that have access to it. I think it's a scam, but, you know, I was just checking.
Sounds pretty scammy to me. What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, that is very likely a scam. And we see these emails, and actually they started, years ago, but we still see them. They're usually going to have the same kind of language. They're going to have a Bitcoin address for you to deposit money so they can remove it. It is extremely likely that you don't have anything on your device, and that they just want to trick you into sending them money. So for me, I would just go ahead and, delete that email. Do not click on any links if there are any links in that email itself. If you did click on a link, that was in the email, I would, be concerned your device might actually have a virus or something on it. So I'd either recommend, running antivirus software or even taking it in for somebody to take a look at it, knowing that there might be something on it. But for all of those, usually it's a scam. You can go ahead and delete it. If you actually do have bad software that might be considered like ransomware or extortionware, where it wants to force you to pay money. They're usually going to lock up your device in a way where you can't even check your email. Like it's going to give you a screen. You're not going to be able to open files, and you're literally going to need to follow those instructions to get access to that data. In this case, it's an email. They just want to trick you into sending them some Bitcoin without, you know, no real need for them to do anything, just hoping that you actually send the money. So highly recommend just delete it and move on.
Very good advice. Good luck with that, John. Kind of scary when you get those, but most cases they're scam, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Jesse LeGrew is our guest. If you've got a question for him, 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back to take those questions in just a bit. Well, we're talking about technology on The Larry Mueller Show today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Jesse is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, where he assists in establishing and implementing strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data and reduce institutional risk. Tell us how you organize the files on your computer, or let us know the way that you use AI in your life, or just ask us a regular question about your tech. We've got open lines, the number 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Kel in Sugar Camp, thank you so much for waiting over the news. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if there was a group, an altruistic group, who's working on AI and algorithms for the general public to use to apply to things they see online, like photographs, speeches, videos, especially with the upcoming political heating up. And I was wondering if anybody is offering that to the general public. I'm sure military and Homeland Security are working feverishly on this, but they're not sharing. And so I was wondering if there's anything that just normal people could use to try to find out if what they're seeing is fake or not.
Okay, thank you, Cal. I think I've heard something about that, Jesse.
Yeah, and that's actually a really interesting question, too. And that's actually really challenging. So I think there are groups out there that are always interested in trying to help with understanding whether there's disinformation, whether the information we're seeing is real or not.
I was going to say, didn't I hear something about an actual AI program that was used to determine whether or not something else was an AI program?
There are. And what's interesting is there's actually one built into OpenAI or ChatGPT as well to determine whether that's real or not. And actually another news article that I had seen over the last week or two was in an academic setting where a professor also submitted students' work to say whether this was fake or not. Well, it said they were fake and they all received failing grades. But from what it sounds like, they were not actually fake. So I think that's one of the challenging items for a lot of these applications is I think the same danger of misinformation that we have for applications, whether it's, you know, hallucination where the program's making up data, or whether it's, you know, by somebody who's just misusing the tool. Being able to detect it is also kind of challenging. And I think that's where, that's probably one of the items that, you know, a subject matter expert, someone that's well-versed in the background, I think really is one of the best ways of detection and determining whether something's real or not. I think AI can help with that. And I think there are tools, there are tools out there right now, even within the academic arena, that help to detect or try to detect whether someone's cheating, whether material might be from a location that, you know, wasn't the student. Maybe it was a previous paper somebody submitted, or it was from, you know, somebody else that had written it from a library. You know, people used to just pay in to cheat. There are applications out there, but I think even within other areas, let's say whether it was the military or somewhere else, I think solely relying on that technology is dangerous potentially, especially if the if it's not correct. So I think the need for real humans to make a determination based upon their knowledge and their expertise, I think, is still extremely important. And then to gather information from a variety of sources. And this is challenging with, I think, not just now, but has been, is the news slanted in one direction or another? And taking multiple viewpoints can help to better understand what those different viewpoints are, but also with different data to help understand maybe what might be, you know, legitimate, might be misunderstood, or might even be, you know, complete lies. Yeah, that was a very long answer to, people are working on it and there are tools out there, but I think we still need to rely on the experts, to help us determine, you know, how much of that is realistic. Mm-hmm. And so those experts are really, really, really needed to help us, kind of filter that information.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kel. Appreciate that call. We were talking about, we're more like written word, but the photographs are, they've really come a long way, haven't they, as far as faking, you know, the Pope wearing a puffy coat. There's all kinds of things out there. It's like, it's really, really difficult to tell. It used to be with Photoshop, you know, you could tell. I mean, anybody that used Photoshop could tell, but now it's just amazing. Although Emily just said that she's heard that they're having problems with hands. So that's kind of hard to do. But is there other ways that you can tell if an image is faked?
Yeah, that's a little bit challenging too. I mean, definitely the artifacts that we know, this is, you know, we know what the world looks like. The fingers is actually really interesting. Somebody actually took a photo that I had posted with my hand and some cherry blossoms, and then had my hand change where I was holding it. But the pinky was really elongated, where it was completely longer than the other digits. And then one, I think, was going in a direction that it shouldn't have been. So there, you know, there are those aspects where, you know, you can kind of tell if you look in the right place. But at a cursory glance, you might also just say, oh, that looks completely real, and just move on. Most people aren't analyzing that picture to determine if it's real or not. There are, you know, applications out there to help identify whether, you know, there might be hidden data within a picture or whether it's legitimate. I think that's going to just continue to be more and more challenging. But there are usually artifacts to help point in the right direction. But those are getting more and more challenging. So I think we will continue to see some challenges with determining whether something is real or not. But I do think when we look at a lot of the data we use every day, there are usually items that come along with a picture or with a video that we don't see, but that are actually tracked in the data. So we have metadata that's usually stored. So if I take a picture with my phone, it's going to state, this is the type of device, this is when it was taken, this is where it was stored. A lot of times you can disable those features, but you're going to have different ways to tell whether a media file might be legitimate or not. Challenging thing is that data can also be changed, just like everything else. So when trying to, you know, forensically review that information, I think it will be a bit more, you know, it's going to be challenging. But we can only trust our eyes so much, I guess.
Sure. Sure. All right, let's go back to the phone. We have Jim in Mercer with a question. Hi, Jim.
Yes, my question is, when you are online and you're dealing with a company, they always want you to download their app. Why don't you, instead of just continuing as a guest or something, they say, download the app. Do they gather more information from you if you have their app on your phone? Is it trustworthy?
Yeah, so the answer to the first question is yes, and answer to the second question is maybe. So when you do have an app installed on your phone, they're able to collect more data. It actually might make consuming the information you want to look at easier. It may be a better experience, but they are able to collect more information either about you, about your device, or about your device usage, depending on the information that it can share. So whenever you download an app, usually that application is going to prompt you, I would like access to this type of data on your device, or this is what I will be collecting. That will give you an idea of at least the data that it's going to be sharing. But one thing that is going to be different from a website where you're viewing content rather than an app, an application might be running in the background or might be collecting data about where you're traveling, or even, you know, might have the permission to access other data on your device. Websites generally going to be a little bit different. You're not going to have the same kind of access. So your own data being released is going to be far less if you use the website than if you use the app. It all depends on the company that you're using. Sometimes, you know, there are malicious or dangerous applications that are out there. They actually might be malware. They might be doing things they really shouldn't be doing, and could give somebody access to your data that you really don't want. Not a legitimate company, or just not a legitimate use. A lot of the application stores, like the Apple App Store, try to maintain a really tight control so that that does not happen, but it's still possible. So it's always safer to just go to the website than the app. But even then, the websites can be questionable too. So I'd say depending on the company, if it's a large enough company, if the data it's asking for is going to be pretty limited, and it's not asking for a large amount of permissions on your device, I think it can be relatively safe. But that's really the big question is, how much data does it want, and how much is it going to supply? Those prompts will help. Sometimes the privacy policy will also help, but those are generally large documents that no one wants to read anyway. So if you'd rather be safe, whenever I get prompted, unless it's something I know that I'm going to be using a lot, I know it's legitimate, and it's going to save me some experience or some struggle working with that provider, I will install the app. If I only want to view it once, if I really don't want to be bothered by it otherwise, I will usually not. And I think most of those cases, when I'm prompted, I don't use the app just because I only wanted it for one little thing anyway. I don't want it collecting my data. I don't want it fed to other systems. So most of the time, I'm going to skip it and only use it when I know I need it all the time.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. I know a lot of those, like, parking apps, you need it for that 1 hour that you're going to be parking, and then you get rid of it because who needs that on there, right?
Yeah.
Carla in Fox Lake, Illinois, how can we help you today?
Hi, thank you. I have two security questions. One is, I'm old school in that I shred any mail with my address on it, or any thing I print out with my email address. Do I need to continue to do this, or can I stop? The other is about the use of cookies. Every website, for-profit, non-profit, wants me to accept them being able to use cookies on my account or inquiry. Am I safer not to give them permission to use the cookie? So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Carla.
Yeah, great question. So paper shredding, I cross cut shred everything, especially if it's a bill or something like that that might go in the garbage or in the recycling. Cross-cut shredding is also the recommendation. So if you only have one of those shredders that gives you the long strips, I always use the cross-cut shredding. The question is, you know, is it needed? If it's just to protect your personal address, it may not be needed, because your address might actually be very easily tracked down. And one thing I'd recommend, and, you know, Googling anything can be a little bit more interesting, but Google your name or Google your address, you're likely to find a location on the internet that has it posted. It also could be, you know, regularly distributed or available from your county. If you have property, there are ways to opt out of that as well. But it's very likely your data is on the internet anyway, and very easy to access. But for bills, anything that might be a little bit more sensitive, I do recommend shredding that before putting it in the mail. People do still dumpster dive, as they call it, and basically try to get information from the trash. And it could expose, you know, sensitive information. If you look at a piece of paper and you're concerned, like, I wouldn't want anyone to see this, shred it. And there's also a lot of great resources out there where you can collect all your items you want to shred and actually deliver it to a third party company. They come and pick it up, and they will usually incinerate it or shred it or do something else itself. You do have to pay a little bit of money for it, but it's actually pretty cost effective, especially if you do have a lot of data to get rid of, because they can do it in bulk, and then you don't have to worry about it yourself. I had a shredding party this weekend, and I think I filled up the bucket like 4 times, and it was not a lot of documents. So sometimes actually going to a different place where it goes into a locked facility, and then somebody else picks it up, and there's a good security around it, I think that can be useful. So yeah, kind of shred what you need to at your own risk, but your personal address might be easy to access. The cookies, I say no. If they want to store cookies, and I have the option to say, no, I don't want you to use cookies, I will do that so that no cookies are stored. If the website does have issues loading or there's some other kind of problem, maybe I'll use cookies. If I did want to be a little bit more paranoid in terms of what cookies are being shared, especially between websites, you can use in private browsing, or it's usually in private or incognito. It depends on the web browser you're using. But that private browsing window will store data a little bit differently and generally try to limit the amount of information being shared. But if you don't need it and it doesn't affect the experience, I would go ahead and not store the cookie. And you can also use, if you have Windows, there are programs that can help you find and delete those cookies. But you can also go to your browser settings, and your browser settings will often have items or settings to not store cookies. Or whenever you close a tab or your entire browser, it will remove those for you immediately. So that way you don't need to worry about doing it yourself.
Okay, thank you very much, Carla and Jesse. I'm very upset you didn't invite me to your shredding party this weekend. It sounds like fun. Anyway, Manuel in Strawberry Point, what a great name, Iowa, emailed, when are regular cellular calls, not with satellite phones, routed over satellites? Would that not add perceptible delays and expense?
So in terms of when it decides to go to a satellite or not, that's actually a good question. It probably depends on where the other phone actually is going, where the other phone's located. Also, whether it's cellular or not, because it may or may not need to traverse the same infrastructure in order to get from point A to point B. But actually, the communication is relatively fast, but with a lot of you know, cellular, you can also transmit in different ways, especially the way we use voice over IP or VoIP, because you can actually go over the basic internet lines. So right now, I could have a conversation with somebody on the other side of the world and really have no delay based upon the infrastructure from point A to point B. It can be pretty close. We were used to that delay with a lot of other technologies, but it does depend on which technology you're using and if it's able to take advantage of other data lines and anything that otherwise might not be kind of restricted by, you know, needing to go out into space, or I should say, you know, maybe low orbit. It depends on what you want to call like inner or outer space, but it's still kind of relatively close. So just depending on your carrier, but it might be routed in different ways.
Okay, great. Rick in Milwaukee, you're next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Sort of in follow-up to the downloading apps exposure question, I'm wondering how much, if any, exposure or compromise we might suffer if we scan, I think they're called QC codes, which I never do, so I'm even hazy on what they're called. I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
You got it right, right, Jesse?
QR codes.
That's right, QR.
Yep. It's actually a good question. So, and we use QR codes are used quite a bit. If you can't think of what that is, there's usually a little squares. You kind of take a picture with your phone, and it usually gives you a website or something, some other internet-based resource. They can be used to deliver bad things. So just like any website you might see as a link in your email, it may go to a bad place, download or install malware or something else. Same thing with QR codes. So I think there is a danger to it. What's interesting is that, I don't know if it was New Year's this year, last year, I think it was New Year's. There are actually drones that were put up over the sky, and I can't remember what location, but they created actually this QR code in the sky. And a lot of people were like, oh, that's interesting. That's kind of cool. And so they scanned it with their phone, and it ended up being a Rickroll. So if you're not familiar with what a Rickroll is, it's, you know, a nice Rick Ashley video, which, you know, once you see, you probably have seen it before. But it ended up being a Rickroll. So anyone who actually, it didn't go to a great, that's all it was. It was just a YouTube video. Nothing useful, nothing interesting, although a great song. I do enjoy it. And I think that was kind of the interesting aspect of, like, should we really be scanning all of these things when we really don't know where they're going to go, what they're associated with, and what the intent of that user might be on the other end. So just like anything in your email, I would have the same kind of questions. Do I know this organization? Does the publication look legitimate? If it does, and if you think it's going to be of use, go ahead and use it. But there is that potential danger of there being something bad behind the scenes. A lot of phones, usually when you do it now, it will actually tell you where it's going to go so that you have that decision before you hit and it goes to the website. So kind of keep an eye on that. But if you don't know it, be careful.
Yeah, don't be too quick about pressing things or clicking on things. That's where I fall into problems anyway. Well, we've been talking with Jesse LeGrew. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Thank you very much, Jesse. It's always good to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
You bet. Why don't you join us tomorrow at this time? Dr. Bill Stork will be back to talk about microchipping your pets and choosing flea and tick preventatives. That's Tuesday starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. Hope you can join us there. And just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts. I'm Jill Nadeau. For Larry Mueller, thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.